In this second selection from the life of Antony, I've given a more or less the complete story up to the time of his emerging from the fort, and then we've jumped ahead to his movement to the inner mountain, to his remote solitude in what then becomes the Monastery of St. Antony on the Red Sea. So it's really in two sections. And what I'd invite you to do is to skip, actually, from this section of his struggling with the demons in the tombs, which is the beginning of his solitary struggle. We might ask ourselves, is this to be taken literally? Do we understand this as a temptation strictly from the demons, or is it a kind of a way of talking about his interior psychological struggle? Surely it is both, in the same way that all of our temptation to sin is both. It includes both our own psychological issues, both the things we've learned, both the problems and habits we carry, but it is also something that has its origin in the demonic. This is not just a metaphor, it is a reality, and it is something with which we all struggle, but Antony's struggles are very vivid indeed, and are intended to highlight how serious this work of coming to terms with one's interior temptations is. If you could skip from the section with his solitary struggle in the tombs, he resolves to undertake this severe asceticism of striving with the demons who are probably visibly represented in the tombs by the wall paintings that he would have seen of the ancient gods and goddesses of Egypt, the animal gods and goddesses. And then dropping down to chapter 11, this is the place where Antony's spiritual life is, as it were, transformed. He resolves to live in extreme solitude. This is something that his spiritual father and advisor won't do with him, because it's something that is unknown. God has assured him that he was with him in the previous struggle in the solitude of the tombs near his village, but now Antony is going to do something rather unique. In chapter 11, he decides to cross over the Nile, and he finds in chapter 12 an abandoned fort in the area of Pispir, across the Nile from the Fayum oasis. And there he lives for 20 years in solitude. Some friends bring bread and drop it in, leave it for him twice a year. And this is possible in Egypt. A very dried bread can survive for a very long time and be a source of nourishment. There would have been water in the fort, of course, a well in this former military establishment. And then in chapter 13, his struggles with the demons here in this new place of solitary struggle is described. Notice that his technique for dealing with the demons is to recite the Psalms. Psalmody has a role in vanquishing the demons and in strengthening and asserting his faith. And then in chapter 14, he emerges from the fort. And this is a beautiful and central part of this life of Antony. He had spent 20 years in solitude in this place. Then his friends come, break down the door and remove it. And I've given a couple of pictures to kind of highlight or illustrate this. And notice the phrase, Antony comes forth as if from a shrine. As if he's been initiated into sacred mysteries, he's filled with the Spirit of God. And he's completely balanced. This is a phrase that is also used by Porphyry in his biography of the philosopher, the pagan philosopher Plotinus. He is wholly balanced, holos isos. He is filled with the Spirit. In Antony's case, it's very clear that Athanasius wishes to describe him as balanced. He is not overly emaciated, nor is he obese. He's not upset by the people because they've interrupted his solitude, nor is he puffed up with pride because they've come to regard him as a spiritual master. As Athanasius puts it, his soul is pure, neither constricted by grief nor dissipated with pleasures, wholly balanced. And then that wonderful phrase, in accordance with nature, according to nature, kata phusin. Antony has attained a life that is in accordance with how God has created him. In this experience of solitude, which actually began, if we'll recall, in his learning holiness from the local Christian community, he's now been purified in this protracted experience of solitude. Now he has balance, and the monastic vision is to live in accordance with nature, not against nature, but as it were, to fulfill nature. And this is a very important premise of Brown's The Body and Society. He points out that the monastic movement was about trying to rediscover what human nature was about, to live as human nature had originally been intended to live in a way that even in a sense brings us to the way God intended us to be before the fall. And then from this point onward, Antony becomes a teacher. And after this section, there's a very long homily, which I have not included, that is a large part of number 14, of chapter 14, and then a portion of chapter 15 and what follows as well. He becomes a teacher, and a large part of his life is a homily, a very, very long homily on the ascetical life which Antony gives. And again, I would encourage you, the full text of the life of Antony is available in the course documents section of the site, and I would encourage you to look at it. Again, it is one of the classics of our tradition, and all we can do here is highlight some of the important areas. I also wanted to emphasize at the end what is often misunderstood about Antony's later life. When he then, having become a great teacher, having been respected as one who can offer a word of life, who can provide the Christian community with a way of integrating the scriptures with their own spiritual struggle, he then seeks an even deeper solitude and crosses the desert again towards the Red Sea. This is seen by some as a complete withdrawal, but that would be false. Antony does not live in absolute isolation or solitude. If you go ahead and read this section, you'll discover, and particularly if you read it in the full text, you will find that when he finds this new location, the so-called inner mountain, and that becomes eventually the site of the community of St. Antony, the monastery of St. Antony on the Red Sea. When he finds this site, he then makes it his practice to go back and forth, to spend time in solitude in his remote inner mountain, but also to come back to the outer mountain, to the former fort, where he spent that time of purification, and that becomes the place where he sees and receives guests. Although people do come to visit him in the inner mountain as well, and he doesn't live completely alone. He has disciples, he has people who live with him. So the image of Antony as living in complete solitary isolation is false. He lives in a small local community with his disciples, and here it is highlighted for us in the latter portion of his life that a principal characteristic of the Christian hermit is his or her availability to the Christian community, to preach, to teach, to make available what God has done for them. Not perhaps all the time, but at intervals. And so the idea of a life lived in complete isolation or separation is not really the model that comes from Antony. Antony has learned from the Christian community what it means to live a life of virtue, and through his growth and purification and solitude, he's been given a wisdom which he now shares with the community, and even in his deepest and most remote solitude, he emerges at intervals from it in order to teach and to help. So there is this interrelationship between community and solitude, very beautifully symbolized in a variety of ways in this classical text, The Life of Antony. And we'll now continue with some selections from the Desert Fathers.